This is an ABC podcast.
This is Big Ideas. I'm Anthony Fennell, sitting in for Paul Barclay. Are you worried that a robot will take your job? There's been a lot of talk about that lately, as artificial intelligence goes ahead in leaps and bounds. AI is already having far-reaching effects on our economy. But will it have similar effects elsewhere? In this Big Ideas, we're going global, travelling along the back roads of artificial intelligence with Duncan McDewey-Ra, a professor of urban sociology at the University of Newcastle. The backroads in this case are developing countries who currently trade on their plentiful supply of cheap labour.
So I've spent much of my recent academic career thinking about urbanisation in different ways. And that interest has brought me to technology, its promise, its present, and importantly in the areas where I work, its absence, and the hope and desire to have it. This is a NASA slide of the Earth at night and over a particular time period. And images like this are used to represent various things, from energy use to population and demographic concentrations to the volume or thickness of economic and industrial activity. And these kinds of images are often used to talk about urbanization. One of the things that they show us are a contrast between bright lights and then seemingly empty or dark spaces. And these images tell us a lot about history, about colonization, industrialization, extraction, economic growth, economic decline, and even poverty, but especially unevenness. For me, as a researcher, I've never really been attracted by those bright lights you see. I've been much more attracted by the dull lights, the little ones. These lights may look dull from afar, but up close they're dramatically bright, especially when compared to the villages and small towns from which they've grown. I'm interested in the dynamics, the events, the changes, the decisions that make some of these lights brighter. Some of them grow and develop, and others stay dull or even dim and disappear as they're bypassed or their resources, human and non-human, diminish or lose value. The dull lights represent rapidly changing patches of the Earth. The bright lights are changing too, but we expect them to change. We expect places like Delhi or Lagos or Cairo or Mexico City or New York or Shanghai to be in a constant flux, a constant state of creation and destruction. But new technologies has enabled many smaller cities and more remote cities to start showing up on maps like this, for their lights to get a little brighter. I've been particularly interested in these dull lights in frontier or border areas, and in the infrastructure projects that connect these dull lights with each other and with brighter lights, whether as transnational highways, fibre optic cables, or simply the trails left by people and goods that go between them. These lights, dull and bright, dimming and getting brighter, are getting better connected as capital, finance, commodities, and crucially data now move more rapidly between them. In a well-known 2009 article, David Bell and Mark Jane noted that in developing countries, 2/3 of urban residents live in places of less than 1 million people. So the global urbanization we're witnessing is not just in megacities. In fact, it's not even mostly in megacities. So while we're used to huge cities teeming with millions and millions of people, we're less used to thinking of massive urbanization in less than massive-sized cities. Bell and Jane go on to argue that if the role and nature of small urbanity is to be more fully understood, a number of imaginative leaps must be taken by theorists currently hung up on the notion that globalization of the city means globalization of the metropolis. And I like this. I like imaginative leaps because they're fun and they're hard, right? But these leaps give us a different perspective on globalization, on global change, when we view it from the dull lights and not just the bright lights. And this is what I think we need to consider when we think about artificial intelligence. I came to artificial intelligence, or AI, via smart cities. India's smart cities mission has pledged funding for 100 smart cities, including new sites, greenfield satellite towns, as well as retrofitting existing cities or patches of existing cities across the country. It's an incredibly ambitious agenda. Most smart cities are built in places that already have a strong technology base. But with 100 smart cities across India, the technology base varies dramatically in different places. In the dull-lit patches where I've been doing research for 20 years, the promise of smart cities has become part of urban planning, of politics, and of resistance in places that were once considered remote, far off, unstable. Smart cities use a lot of artificial intelligence in their design, and I began to wonder what it meant for technology to suddenly accelerate in these places, and how people living there engage with it. And that interest brought me to artificial intelligence. I actually began thinking about AI from the dull lights and not the other way around. And I realized that a lot of the talk about AI, a lot of the ideas, concerns, and anxieties are voiced from the bright lights, are heard from the bright lights, and are talked about in the bright lights. But what does AI look like in these dull lights, in these more out-of-the-way places, along the back roads of globalization and technology proliferation? And I was less interested in the technology per se, more the social and political debates around AI. So what is artificial intelligence? You probably already have a good grasp of it. Some of you may know it intimately, some more distantly. And the ways you understand or think about AI is probably shaped by what you read in the media, through headlines such as this: how to prepare students for the rise of the artificial intelligence in the workforce. Or this: robots to take 400,000 finance jobs in the next decade. Or this: Google's Duplex uses AI to mimic humans, sometimes. Amazon uses an AI to automatically fire low productivity workers. It's a grim glimpse of a future in which AI is your boss and you're disposable. Nobel Peace Prize-winning doctors warn killer autonomous robots must be banned. These are all taken from 2 weeks of headlines. I didn't have to look very hard. One of the problems we have with artificial intelligence, as the late Professor Marvin Minsky has put it, is that it can be a bit of a suitcase concept. So a suitcase concept means we tend to gather up all kinds of things and throw them into it. And we often mistake other forms of technology, some very close to AI, some not, and then we carry them all in this suitcase when we think about AI. And we do that, I think, for good reason. I'm sympathetic to this, because it's very hard to understand exactly what AI is. It's a little unclear what's in the suitcase and what should stay out, what it encompasses, where its boundaries are, and where to make of them. And the boundaries keep shifting. It's such a rapidly moving field that once you understand a bit of it, it keeps going further and further and further. But at the same time, we're continually bombarded with images and headlines that seem to roll all of the future into this one concept. All of our anxieties, all of our fears, all of our plans into this one thing. So here are a few useful ways of understanding AI. Margaret Boden, who's written extensively about AI, has provided a simple definition of artificial intelligence as describing the field that seeks to make computers do the sort of things that minds can do. Greg Corrado from Google Brain underscores the focus in AI research on new challenges. He says, "It's not about what a machine knows or understands, but what it does, and more importantly, what it doesn't do yet." It's also useful to talk of the algorithms that machines use to make decisions. For example, those where rules for algorithms are generated by experts and then applied to a particular problem, like scheduling in a factory. Or AI as machine learning, a process whereby a learning algorithm is used to generalize patterns from data and make predictions from these patterns. So one helpful way to think about AI is machines that have the capacity to learn from data in ways that are autonomous. They can do it more or less on their own once programmed, and adaptive, they can learn as they go. Thus, data is increasingly valuable to power AI. And as we've seen in examples from recent years, data is so valuable that it seems to outstrip our capacity for ethics, judgment, and governance. The production of data, the existence of data, is also dramatically uneven in different parts of the world. And even in some parts of the world, it's dramatically uneven among populations. So this is probably a good time to better understand the backroads. They help us draw out this unevenness. I've been inspired by a number of researchers who focus on low-end or everyday globalization. And in particular, the work of Professor Caroline Knowles from Goldsmiths in London, who wrote a book in 2014 about flip-flops, or what we more civilized people would call thongs. The book, Flip-Flop, A Journey Through Globalization's Backroads, is remarkable. Knowles follows the flip-flop trail from Kuwait, where it begins as a petroleum byproduct, to Korea to be refined, to several sites in China, to various ports and shipping containers, to an attack by pirates, markets across the Horn of Africa, and finally to an enormous garbage dump in Ethiopia. Knowles terms the back roads an alternative set of routes that depart from the main roads of hegemonic globalization. She adds that journeys along these back roads, these trails, expose the missing urban geographies of globalization. They provide a series of lenses through which cities can be apprehended and analyzed. And these backroads bring us to different national systems, laws, policies, and down to local workers, communities, and families. We can follow one thing, one kind of technology, AI, and navigate through these different systems in this way. The backroads is an important idea for us whenever we're confronted with statements about the world, globalization, value chains, new technology, and artificial intelligence, because it forces us to stop and think about different perspectives, about what these big ideas and big changes look like on the edges, away from the main arena, away from the main stage, from the patches with dull lights. Viewing AI from the backroads raises a different set of questions about the future. And some of these questions align very closely with questions we would ask about AI in Australia, but some are quite different. So when people talk of AI as a fourth or fifth industrial revolution that will completely change the world, which world are they talking about? Which patches? And how might AI unfold in parts of the world either still reeling from earlier industrial revolutions, or where livelihoods depend upon the kind of work directly under threat from AI, much of which is outsourced from developed countries to begin with, and actually under AI is being in danger of being reshored, of going back, having robots do it at home, which is cheaper than labor from overseas. So at the heart of these questions is trying to come to a better understanding of the relationships between AI and development. Because whatever your views are on development, the best ways to achieve it, who's responsible for it, at what scale it should be sought, I can assure you that on the back roads, development is at the forefront of ways people think about AI, and in the ways governments have to calibrate AI into something that will benefit large numbers of people, continue to lift people out of poverty, and alleviate insecurity. And this is the relationship at the heart of my interest in AI. In a recent BBC radio documentary, Ian Golden, professor of globalization and development at Oxford University and former vice president of the World Bank Group, wrestled with the question of whether AI will kill development. Golden begins in Kenya, with workers tagging images to be read by self-drive cars, and asks, "Is technology, especially automation and artificial intelligence, going to allow countries to steal a march on development and leap ahead, or is it going to be their undoing?" Golden's view is interesting, not only for the way he shapes the question, not only for the idea that countries are competing with each other to reach some end goal and AI might allow them to steal a march, we still have an idea we're reaching towards something. But it's interesting because there's generally been very little overt consideration of the relationships between AI and development, at least in the bright lights. That's something we need to unravel along the back roads. So tonight I have three scenes I want to visit briefly. Three moments where people are engaging with the relationships between AI and development. Scene one, the Google community space in San Francisco, California, March 2018. The event, Artificial Intelligence for Economic Development, a series of talks and a conference initiated by the World Bank's Development Impact Evaluation Initiative, or DIME, in partnership with the University of California's Center for Effective Global Action. It's early days yet, but the World Bank's interest in AI to address development problems and the potential partnerships with the technology sector associated with AI suggests artificial intelligence is moving closer to the mainstream of development ideas, action, and importantly, partnerships with the tech sector. It should not be a surprise that an interest in AI is driven by DIME, which evolved in response to the increasing demand to improve development effectiveness as hostility to development aid has taken hold among many traditional donor governments in the last decade, including Australia. At the same time, new and emerging donors are increasing their role in development assistance, and have done so for the last 20 years. Thus, AI comes to the development sector following a turn towards quantitative impact evaluation, which lends itself to technologies that can make data out of poverty, displacement, the impacts of disasters, and climate variations. This may seem out of kilter with conventional images of development assistance as a person-to-person endeavor. But make no mistake, data is big in development assistance. It has to be, as the sector is under increasing pressure to prove its effectiveness and efficiency.
Urban sociologist Professor Duncan McGiwi-Ra and digital technology in the developing world.
The 2018 event featured a high-profile lineup of speakers from the academic, tech, and development world. And from it emerges a threefold agenda for artificial intelligence and development at the global level that will emanate along the back roads. First, AI is immensely valuable for producing knowledge about poverty. AI that utilizes big data can be invaluable for cheaply and effectively understanding and predicting poverty, hunger, land and resource use and misuse, infrastructure needs, urbanization patterns, migration patterns, conflict impacts, displacement, among many other challenges. Second, AI can change the way aid is delivered to previously unidentified or hard-to-reach recipients. Everything from pilotless drones delivering blood supply to precision agriculture anticipating yields, droughts, and severe weather events. This could indeed be revolutionary, considering remoteness and distance from services exacerbates poverty and can be a major trigger for urban migration. Third, AI is a learning tool for the sector. It can evaluate the impact of development interventions, improve internal data, and use blockchain technology to feed back into the operations and practices of big organizations like the World Bank, donor governments, and NGO partners, all of which have the potential to transform the sector and change things along the backroads. But despite the language of transformation littered through the event and the accompanying commentary, the AI and development agenda is mostly concerned with how experts can be better empowered to solve problems in distant places. The benefits of AI are that poverty can be fought from afar with greater precision, provided the algorithms are right. There were certainly exceptions to this at the event, notably a for-profit startup that seeks to develop chatbots that can help the poor navigate complex bureaucracies, especially when there are language obstacles. But even in this, one of the more practical examples from the conference, the poor end users, the subjects of development intervention, are at best co-producers of data, of knowledge about their lives in codes that can be read by machines. For the most part, the poor are not creators of the machines or algorithms in question, or even modifiers. They just provide the input. And there's currently a race on to test these new forms of technology in lots of developing countries. In this way, AI doesn't transform the power relations in development that much, at least when viewed from the back roads, from the dull lights and dark spaces. The transformation is all at the other end. Transformation of knowledge about development problems and the best solutions. Indeed, the battle being fought, very politely I might add, in the AI and development assistance space seems to be between the information expert and the development expert, the latter suddenly anxious that their future may be at stake. So as this battle rages on, let's head to Delhi, India's capital city, for scene two. Delhi and the AI for All strategy. In Delhi, the national government of India, led by the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, which was recently re-elected, has made AI an overt part of its development strategy, which also includes a raft of other technology-focused initiatives. The focus on AI is manifest in the 2018 discussion paper, National Strategy for Artificial Intelligence, or AI for All, published by Niti Aayog, the National Institute for Transforming India, a government think tank very close to the seat of power, created controversially in 2015. AI for All emerged as part call to arms. Twice in the report is the adage, the need of the hour is to develop a policy framework that will set up a vibrant AI ecosystem in India. It's part endorsement of the current regime's initiatives towards technological development generally, and AI specifically. And it's a part lament at the inefficacy of existing institutions to maximize India's potential. These government institutions that keep getting in the way, regulations, laws, protective discrimination, etc. India has a lot of potential for recalibrating AI, with taking it and making it into a technology of use for hundreds of millions of people. AI for All focuses on five opportunities for AI in India around healthcare, focusing on access, quality, and affordability, in agriculture, boosting income and productivity from declining land and labor. A large part of the strategy document is on education, improving access, quality, and teacher training. The fourth pillar is smart cities, aligning with the smart cities mission I mentioned earlier. And fifth is smart mobility and transportation. I won't go into these one by one. The 180-page strategy paper provides plenty of detail about the ways AI can improve all these sectors. But what's most striking about AI for All for me is the way it positions India as a second-tier AI hub. The report labels India a garage for 40% of the world, assuming this means the population of India and lots of other countries in the global south. And it's from here many backroads will fan out. AI will travel from what's developed in India to other parts of the world. The report suggests India provides a perfect playground for enterprises and institutions globally to develop scalable solutions which can be easily implemented in the rest of developing and emerging economies. So as this playground takes shape, this experimental space for a version of AI that can benefit the masses, India also reinforces its position as a benevolent rising power, as a champion of development. In Mixing Technology and Populism, the report stresses the need to take advantage of India's global positioning. It says, as AI matures and generalized applications become commonplace, it's advantage India when it comes to large-scale implementation, especially when it comes to adding incremental value to technology developed elsewhere. However, AI will be a massive risk to India's IT sector, especially the backroom IT that sustains many of the jobs in so-called business process outsourcing, known as BPO generally in India, call centers, software development, and data management. Concentrated in a few cities, Bangalore, Hyderabad, and to a lesser extent, Kolkata and the Delhi National Capital Territory, which is Delhi City and the towns of Noida and Gurgaon, the sector draws hundreds of thousands of migrant workers from across the country. So much so that in recent years, the government has tried a local BPO strategy, trying to get these things to grow in smaller cities and towns. As Biao Xiang notes, who's written about the Indian IT sector, a complex industry of labor agents, recruiters, tutors, fixers, and even travel agents are all entangled in the Indian IT sector, including within India and for Indian workers traveling abroad to the US, Australia, and the UK to work in IT. He calls these body shops. These body shops manage IT workers on behalf of employers, moving them from client to client or through periods on the bench between contracts. Bao argues persuasively that, quite the opposite of what is usually assumed, software development services are highly labor-intensive, particularly at the phase of programming, testing, and debugging. AI will heavily impact this sector. It'll heavily impact the labor-intensive side of the IT industry, which remains poorly organized, barely unionized, and highly casualized. AI for All stresses the need to train and upskill the existing IT workforce to handle the demands of the AI future. Though it's difficult to imagine that all of the backroom workforce will be well placed for such a rupture. Where these backroom workers will go when the body shops gear down or close entirely is a compelling question for local governments, where local labor markets are both unattractive and incapable of absorbing even small portions of the IT workforce. But AI for All as a strategy document does recognize this problem. The report notes that despite over 2 million STEM graduates in India in 2016 alone, an overwhelming majority of this talent pool is focused on routine IT development and not so much on research and innovation. So in discussing recommendations, the report notes, our large numbers of IT workers may soon turn from potential assets to liabilities if the right structures are not put in place. The exact nature of these right structures remains ambiguous. It's not mentioned in the report. It appears the task of reabsorbing body workers from the IT sector will fall on local governments. Governments already grappling with ways to accommodate educated populations. Governments like Manipur. And let's not even think about where all the redundant IT hardware will go. But what choice does India have? It can't exactly sit out AI, given the size of the population, competition from other IT providers, such as the Philippines, which will also automate, the potential AI offers for new jobs and new sectors of growth, and the priorities of the present government around more deeply enrolling India in global flows of technology. So as this garage for the rest of the world, adaptations of AI will emanate from India along the backroads within and beyond its borders in intended and unintended ways. And we can begin to think this through by travelling to India's geographic limits and the state of Manipur. Manipur is a state in India's far eastern frontier, sharing a border with Myanmar, a formerly independent kingdom that's been occupied continuously since 1891, first by British and then Indian armed forces. Manipur has been home to various armed secessionist movements, anti-state movements, and inter-ethnic conflicts. From the late 1950s, parts of the state have been subject to the notorious Armed Forces Special Powers Act, or AFSPA, affording legal protection to the Indian military and paramilitary for acts committed against the civilian population. Now one of India's 29 states, Manipur's capital city is Imphal, a city of about 500,000 people, around the same size as Newcastle. My relationship with Imphal goes back at least a decade, when I started working with migrants who left the frontier and were living and working in Delhi, over 2,000 kilometres away. And many of these migrants worked in call centres and backroom IT. During this research, I followed migrants home, and that led me to Imphal, and I became obsessed with the city. I've been told that I talk about Imphal the way people talk about Paris. I think about it, I dream about it, and maybe you can see some resemblance. Imphal intrigued me because it seemed like a city people couldn't wait to leave, but also passionately fought over. Every lakai, every neighbourhood, a battleground in a fight against occupation, settlement, corruption, history, the future. Eventually, I wrote a book about the city that I researched by walking it again and again through different seasons, through different political moments. And this is why we come to Imphal on our backroads tour of AI, because it's familiar. The abstract projections of AI for all in Delhi and the Dime Conference in San Francisco are more real to me here. I can see, I can think them through. Manipur doesn't have an AI policy or plan. And granted, we could zoom into almost any state in India away from the tech hubs and look for traces of AI and see a disjuncture between what's planned and what exists. Yet Manipur is different. The implications of AI for all are felt in a state where the experience of Indian democracy has often been brutal, where dependency on remittances sent from migrants working in sectors affected by AI is high, and where AI has a closer alignment to surveillance and control than emancipation and opportunity. The implications of AI for all will affect Manipur in many ways, particularly agriculture, but I'm going to focus on two here to keep the thread going: IT workers and surveillance technology. IT workers. In 2015, the government of Manipur released its own IT strategy, in response to the National Digital India Strategy. Along with digitizing government services, it seeks to establish an IT sector in Manipur to better train locals for jobs outside and create 50,000 IT jobs in the state itself in the 5 years to 2020. It does this through a series of incentives for investors, from easy land transfers to partnerships in a technology park to subsidies for training local employees. Leaving aside the very real difficulties of investing in Manipur and the slow progress on this vision a year out from 2020, the interesting element in this for us is that the plan seeks to prepare young people for work in a sector that is under threat. Though this shows how dependent Manipur is on young people migrating out and sending money back. Young people from Manipur seek work in hospitality, IT and call centres, and in the health sector, especially as nurses, another sector under threat from AI. But sticking with IT, as the body shops gear down, how will Manipur absorb returning workers? Manipur has proven to be a very fragile polity. Inter-ethnic tensions have resulted in citizen-enforced blockades that have isolated Imphal from the rest of India and the Myanmar border for months at a time in various episodes over the last decade, causing shortages of fuel, food, black marketeering, and a complete dismantling of inter-ethnic trust. The politics here are complex, but a recurring theme is the ineffectiveness of protections for local communities from outside labour. Outside meaning labour from other parts of India and debates to reinstitute restricted entry into Manipur. And outside also meaning different communities within Manipur and to push to secure stronger constitutional protections for land and labour for communities living under different land and constitutional regimes. If people are willing to block off their state capital for months at a time to stop their land and labour being taken by humans from another ethnic community, I wonder how they'll respond to competition from returnees, themselves displaced from AI and automation. Furthermore, remittances not only keep families afloat, but they're invested in construction in the city, in businesses, particularly in school building, in infill and other areas, creating local employment. Outmigration has been crucial for mobilising young women into paid work, and it's been crucial in giving people, especially young people, periods away from the stress of living in a militarised environment. What happens when the body shops gear down? What AI for All calls the risk of turning potential assets to liabilities. Manipur, heavily indebted, economically dependent on Delhi, and governed under systems of parallel authority through the military, has limited capacity to cope. The whole state is already considered a liability in India. AI for All outlines several key advantages of AI for improving surveillance under the Smart Cities mission. The report notes, AI technology could provide safety through smart command centres with sophisticated surveillance systems that could keep checks on people's movements, potential crime incidents, and general security of the residents. And across India, this has a lot of appeal for people, especially in middle-class residential areas. But in Imphal, it's a bit of a different story. In the city's successful smart city bid, Imphal's municipal government reports on a new electronic surveillance regime currently underway, featuring, to quote, continuous monitoring and barricading of the core area and installation of CCTV in more than 100 locations. Yes, you heard right. A city is bragging about barricading the entire centre of its downtown. Monitoring, barricading and CCTV have a different meaning in Manipur, where government is experienced through constant surveillance. The persistence of extraordinary laws makes acquiescence to surveillance, checking and questioning mandatory. And there are checkpoints everywhere. I walked the city for many months over many years. Movement through the city or between parts of the state necessitate proving one's identity, purpose, and harmlessness. Any encounter, from a seemingly routine stop at a checkpoint on a busy road to a combing mission through a border village, can quickly escalate into detention, violence, even death. Under AFSPA, there's no recourse for those affected. The Act ensures impunity for members of the military and paramilitary. Local activists are currently pursuing the disappearance of over 1,500 civilians in Manipur, a staggering number, and one that does not just include those murdered, assaulted, and imprisoned. It doesn't count those at all. It's just those that have vanished, where there's no bodies. A long-standing tactic of the military and paramilitary has been to accuse victims of association with banned organisations, or label them terrorists, even staging what human rights groups call fake encounters to justify their actions. AI and facial recognition technology offers some potential to better identify those accused of association. But the threshold for association is pretty low. And considering Manipur's history, almost everyone knows someone who's involved in so-called banned organizations. An emerging fear is that a machine that uses facial recognition to track a person and lead to their arrest and detention cannot be reasoned with. There's no scope for human appeal. To say, please, you have the wrong person. To say, you see me passing here every day, I'm just taking my kids to school. To say, this backpack just has my shopping in it. Facial recognition technology also assumes easily identifiable lines between good and bad elements in society, lines that have proven impossible to police in Manipur. As China has shown in the western Xinjiang province, AI can be used to control ethnic minority populations in mundane ways, in ways woven into the built environment of towns and cities, and justify it as weeding out anti-government or anti-national elements with little prospect of opposition. In a place like Manipur, this is a frightening future. So to end, returning to Ian Golden in the BBC documentary I mentioned earlier, in answering the question of whether AI will kill development, he broke the question into two. Will AI allow developing countries to make a leap, or will it be their undoing? A definitive answer doesn't appear possible yet. Golden himself errs more towards the undoing part. But perhaps there's a different way to pose the question. Namely, how will AI exacerbate or ameliorate existing inequalities, existing patterns of uneven development, at global, national, and crucially, at local levels? It seems to be that AI will mould itself to the uneven geographies of development, flattening inequalities here and there, making new ones elsewhere, and leaving some things completely untouched. My take-home message is a series of further questions. The next time you're dealing with AI, reading about it, dreaming about it, fearful of a machine rating your job performance, trying to frighten 18-year-olds about the future, think of these questions. When we talk about the world not being the same, Which world are we talking about? What change are we referring to? When we talk of the implications of a fourth or fifth industrial revolution, how do we imagine this will play out in places reeling from previous industrial revolutions? How does the anxiety or promise of machines replacing human labor feel in places where human labor is still cheaper than machines? And getting to those employment markets was such a struggle over so long. In a world of global flows, the downsides of AI will be experienced differently in different parts of the world. And how might these reflect past and present instances of outsourcing, downsizing, and the on-selling of hazard, danger, and death to other places far from view? The answers to these questions, I argue, vary depending on where you stand, and especially how bright or dull the lights. Thank you.
The Backroads of Artificial Intelligence, a lecture by Duncan McDewey-Rah, a professor of urban sociology at the University of Newcastle.